Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.
Carl Sandburg called his Chicago the City of Big Shoulders.
A generation later, Gwendolyn Brooks wondered if a dream could sing an aria in a ghetto building on Chicago's South Side.
Two poets and two very different views of the Midwest's biggest city.
From Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Storylines Midwest. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Keith Taylor. Today, Carl Sandburg, Gwendolyn Brooks, and the poetry they found in the Midwest.
And we'd like to hear from you with your questions, your stories, and your favorite Midwestern poets. The number to call is 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762.
It's Storylines Midwest. At the beginning of the 20th century, no one thought about the Midwest as a place for poetry. The frontier was closed, and now we were going to build factories and grow crops. We were going to work hard, and we weren't going to have time or need for something like poetry. But that didn't work, at least not for everyone. Almost immediately, people started feeling the need for a poetry that would both celebrate their lives and offer the possibilities of a larger life of the imagination.
One of the Midwest's most well-known poets is Carl Sandburg. Sandburg was born in Galesburg, Illinois in 1878. He was the son of poor Swedish immigrants. He started writing poetry as a young man while working as a manual laborer. And throughout his career, his concern for working people was a recurring theme in his poetry. In 1916, he published his Chicago poems, which were both a critical and a popular success. He went on to publish many other collections of poetry, novels, and a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Abraham Lincoln. He was also one of the first popular public performers of his own work, which also included folk songs. He won a second Pulitzer for his collected poems, and he died in 1967.
The Chicago poems begin with the poem Chicago. Maybe not one of his most interesting poems, but with this poem, Sandburg created the phrases that are still used to describe Chicago to this day. Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it is true, I have seen the gunman kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head, singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning. Flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job, here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities. Fierce as a dog, with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth, under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who's never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing, laughing the stormy, husking, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation.
Carl Sandburg was the first poet laureate of the state of Illinois. The second one was Gwendolyn Brooks. Gwendolyn Brooks was born in 1917 in Topeka, Kansas, but for most of her life, she lived and worked on the south side of Chicago. She began writing at an early age, and in her teen years, she published poems in children's publications. She moved on to writing articles for Chicago's famous black newspaper, The Chicago Defender, and by the end of the Depression, she was publishing her work in such prestigious places as Chicago's Poetry Magazine. In 1945, she published her first volume of poetry, A Street in Bronzeville, which was a huge success, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for her second collection, Annie Allen, in 1950. She was the first African-American to win a Pulitzer.
Here's Gwendolyn Brooks reading perhaps her most famous poem, We Real Cool, with the subtitle The Pool Players, Seven at the Golden Shovel.
We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
Both Carl Sandburg and Gwendolyn Brooks found some of their first successes in the pages of Chicago's Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly poetry journal in the English-speaking world. It was first published in 1912, and with us now is the current editor of Poetry Magazine, Joseph Parisi. We'd also like to hear from you with your questions, your comments, and some of your favorite Midwestern poets. The number is 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. Hello, Joe.
Greetings.
It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Poetry Magazine was founded in Chicago in 1912, and when I try to imagine Chicago in 1912, that seems like an unlikely place and an unlikely time for a poetry journal to be founded. How did that come about?
Well, there were a lot of people who felt the same way, particularly on the East Coast. There were many guffaws heard in New York and Boston. How could the pork packers of Chicago presume to have a poetry magazine of all things? Although Chicago already had a literary tradition, quite a good one, and rather distinguished publications. The Dial, for example, started in Chicago. The Chapbook, which was one of the early fine arts kinds of journals, started here. And, of course, the city itself was hardly a pioneer town anymore. It had the its own symphony orchestra, the Chicago Symphony, the Art Institute, big museums, the University of Chicago. In fact, because of that, when Harriet Monroe, the founder, looked around her, she wondered, well, what about poetry? Why doesn't it get some recognition? So, the other thing I'd say, yeah, pardon me?
No.
I was just going to ask you, so when the magazine started, what were the original goals of the magazine?
Well, her goals were pretty straightforward. One thing she wanted to do was give a place for poets who didn't write the kind of poems that were in the big magazines. Most of the time, you have to realize that at that time, the leading magazines just wanted poems to fill out columns, and they wanted kind of light verse, uplifting kinds of things. And she wanted to pay poets. In fact, poetry has always paid poets. Even when it was near bankruptcy, which happened any number of times over the years. And third, and perhaps the most important for her, was to create what she called the great audience.
So it was the great audience. There wasn't any particular tie to the Midwest. She wasn't going to push Midwestern poets in particular.
No, because she knew a lot of them and because a lot of them got their start here. Besides Sandburg, of course, there's Vachel Lindsay, mm-hmm. who was an even bigger success. He was probably the first performance poet, famous beyond belief for many years, going around the country giving these dramatic recitations of his work. The fact was that she always had a kind of international outlook, and she was not – this is what's interesting. She started it without a real, you could say, program in mind. She didn't have a definite idea what it was going to be. She just said very straightforwardly, we were going to have an open door, and any kind of poetry, whatever it comes from, whoever it's by, whatever its particular point of view, that's what she would publish as long as it was good or interesting.
How did she find the poetry that she wanted to publish?
Well, once it got started, it became fairly famous fast because of Vachel Lindsay and the reaction to his poems. There were many who said this isn't poetry at all. And, of course, like Tallulah Bankhead once said, I don't care what they say about me as long as they keep talking. So it got a lot of bad publicity, which brought a lot of poems in. But she also got a response when she sent out her first solicitation from a young man, virtually unknown, named Ezra Pound, who volunteered to be her foreign correspondent. So he sent over a lot of stuff. made it appear that he was really the very center of all this literary activity there, a very important person indeed. And a lot of the people he sent in were virtually unknown, too. But he made it sound like this was a big movement. He called it imagism. And these were basically people he knew or came across in the little circles there in London at the time. The most famous poem that he sent in was The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot, who was, as I said, unknown at the time.
And that was its first publication in poetry?
That was his very first publication in poetry and his very first publication ever.
Who was reading Poetry Magazine at the time?
Well, it's hard to tell because we don't have the lists of who the subscribers were. The primary readers, of course, were other poets. And her list of guarantors, these were people in Chicago mainly who backed her by giving $50 a year for 5 years to guarantee it would get off to a good start. All of them read it. And then it's quite clear after about a year, it got lots of publicity in papers around the country, so that there were subscribers all over the place, all over the country and abroad.
You're listening to Storylines Midwest, and our guest this evening is Joseph Parisi, the editor of Poetry Magazine. We'd love to hear from you with your questions and your comments and some of your favorite Midwestern poets as well. The number to call is 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Keith Taylor. Joe had mentioned Vachel Lindsay and his performance qualities. Before we get too far away from Carl Sandburg, I want to bring it back and so we can hear Carl Sandburg read one of his own poems. This is a sort of atypical Carl Sandburg poem, but has always been one of my favorites. This is his poem, Mag, from the Chicago Poems.
I wish to God I never saw you, Mag. I wish you never quit your job and came along with me. I wish we never bought a license and a white dress for you to get married in the day we ran off to a minister and told him we would love each other and take care of each other always and always long as the sun and the rain lasts anywhere. Yes, I'm wishing now you lived somewhere away from here and I was a bum on the bumpers 1,000 miles away, dead broke. I wish the kids had never come. And rent and coal and clothes to pay for. And a grocery man calling for cash, everyday cash for beans and prunes. I wish to God I never saw you, Mag. I wish to God the kids had never come.
So, Joe, I don't know why that's one of my favorite poems, but I loved it when I was 14, and I still do. I get a shiver when I hear him read that. It's very different from Sandburg's other poems. It's not positive. It's not that sort of celebration of the people, the celebration of Chicago. It's kind of a sad poem. Do you have an image of Sandburg? Is there still an image of Sandburg in Chicago? Do people still think of him?
Well, as long as he's taught in schools, he'll never be forgotten. I suppose every student at some point early in his or her career comes across Fog, mm-hmm. which is the very short poem, The Fog Comes on Little Cat Feet. It sits looking over harbor and city on silent haunches and then moves on. It's a little imagistic poem, which is very much influenced by the sort of poetry that Pound was espousing at the time, stripped down to very, very basic images, very concrete things that you can see. And that was the major change, I think, that was wrought through poetry and the little magazines that followed it after it was such a success, to get away from that kind of abstract language, the highfalutin terminology and these platitudes, and get right down and look at the world the way it is.
What was Sandburg's relationship with Poetry Magazine?
It was very close. He worked for the magazine, actually, for a while. In fact, there's a wonderful picture we have of him in a biography by a man named John Gould Fletcher, who's virtually forgotten now, was fairly well known at the time, another one of Pound's protégés, by the way. And he came through Chicago in 1915 after some years in London, and he stopped by the office, and there was Sandburg with a bowler hat, a cigar in his mouth, and with his feet propped up on Harriet Monroe's desk reading proofs. He didn't even bother to look up and say hello. He wasn't a very good proofreader, by the way.
Why doesn't that surprise me? 20 years after Sandburg, the next generation of poets out of Chicago, Gwendolyn Brooks, who had been publishing a fair amount in the black press in Chicago, she's still a very young woman, but she had her first big national break by publishing a poem in poetry. How did she connect with the magazine?
Well, she goes back quite a few years before she actually got published. She started sending into poetry, I think, when she was about 14 years old, maybe younger. And she would get little notes back, encouraging, but no one took anything. And then one of the staff members on poetry, a woman named Ines Bolton, was teaching on the South Side, and she had her in a class and encouraged her. But it was actually Paul Engel, who later became famous as the head of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, who really pushed her. She won a contest. He was teaching, I think, up at Northwestern at the time. And he's the one who really, I think, paved the way for her.
Was poetry publishing very many African-American writers at that time?
Oh, yes, it always had right from the start. County Cullen, Langston Hughes, some of his very first poems in there. It's quite a long list, actually.
You could call us and join the conversation at 866-255-2762. We have a call right now from David from Detroit, Michigan. Good evening, David.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. You wanted to ask us something.
Well, I just wanted to call in with my two favorite Midwest poets. Of course, from Detroit area, be Robert Hayden, who was a professor at the University of Michigan until he passed away 2 years back, and Phil Levine, who's down in California, but both of those wrote a great deal about the Detroit area. I wonder what you thought of them.
Well, I'm certainly familiar with their work. I've even met both of them. But how about you, Joe? What do you think about Robert Hayden and Phil Levine?
Well, they're still, I think, have a lot of things to say that are very pertinent. I know Phil rather well. He's still going strong, writing, I think, at the top of his form. He has a lot to say about his experiences as a youth. I don't think he's been actually laboring in steel plants or car factories for at least 60 years now,
right.
but it left an indelible mark. And what's interesting, of course, in both cases is the attention paid to the common man, let's say, the ordinary working person, and the realities of their lives.
I'm sorry. You continue.
This is, of course, part of that tradition of Sandburg's and Lindsay's, too, going back. You know, Sandburg was a socialist and wrote for a number of socialist papers, and he had that proletarian sympathy all the way through. Phil Levine, I think, has the same thing without quite the polemical aspect and not quite the simple-mindedness. I think a great deal of Sandburg's stuff just doesn't go very far. He never really quite developed. He more often repeated himself. Well, he was a reporter. He was a newspaper man, and he is in a tradition of an even more illustrious newspaper man turned poet, and that, of course, is Walt Whitman. So you have a lot of lists, a lot of journalistic detail.
Was that
I'm
conscious?
Sure. It gets very deep, though.
Was that conscious on Sandburg's part to pick up the Whitman influence and bring it to the Midwest?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, sure.
I want to let David know that we are going to be taking a closer look at Detroit poetry coming up in the next half of the hour. And Joe, I want to ask you about Poetry Magazine now. What kind of a role is it playing now in the literary community?
Well, we're now the largest of the little magazines. And we're distributed throughout the country, every state, and 44 countries around the world. We get about 90,000 poems a year sent
wow.
in. So that gives you some kind of idea. We're particularly interested, as poetry always has been, in young people, in giving them their starts, promoting interesting new talents. And one of the joys of the job is being able to present, oftentimes for the first time, a young poet who's just starting out. We publish quite a number of them, actually, who are still in school. And the reward is to get these wonderful letters usually about a week after the magazine comes out. We're still monthly. We've never missed a single issue. Saying, I got calls from all over the country. I had no idea so many people read your magazine. And I had an editor call me saying he wanted some of my poems, and it looks like my book's going to get published. And so this is really quite a frequent occurrence around the office.
That's amazing.
So, but we do still publish, of course, all the leading authors who are very nice to us, giving us the title poems of their new volumes and so on, because they're very faithful to the magazine, because they got their start in the magazine.
With that many contributions every year, how do you go through all of them and decide what you're going to publish?
Well, the first thing you have to do is read them, and we actually do read them. I'm given to understand by certain people that that isn't always the case in other magazines, but you're not going to be able to make the discoveries if you don't actually go through the manuscripts. And anything that comes to my desk, I'd see maybe 15% to 20% of what comes in. I've tried all these years to write at least a little note to give them an indication that I really did read it, because for the most part, writing is a very lonely life, and I think that to have some sense that there's somebody at the end there who at least gave it serious attention can be a big encouragement.
Do you feel these days that Chicago supports you, is proud of Poetry Magazine? Is poetry connected to the city?
Well, I think that it's a curious thing that, like most prophets, you're honored more outside your own home than your own hometown. Not that it isn't known here and recognized, but I think that perhaps in New York and California, we may be in the hierarchy of things more prestigious, say, than in our own hometown. Which is understandable in a way. You can be taken for granted. We've always been here, and I guess it's assumption that we always would be. Also maybe there's assumption that we've got this great big endowment or something, which is not the case at all. We've always been sort of walking the straight and narrow and sometimes getting really close to the edge. I spend most of my time actually raising money, to tell you the truth, to keep it going.
No, that's too bad.
You're listening to Storylines Midwest, and our guest is Joseph Parisi, the editor of Poetry Magazine. We'd like to hear from you with your questions, with your comments, if you'd like to talk about Carl Sandburg or Gwendolyn Brooks, or if you'd like to talk about other Midwestern poetry that's influenced you. We'd like to hear from you. The number to call is 866-255-2762, 866-255-2762. And Mary is on the line in Iowa City, Iowa. Hello, Mary.
Hello. I'd like to talk about three of my favorite poets. One is Darwin Turner. He's from Cincinnati, and he wrote a book called In a Minor Chord, and Haki Matabuti from Chicago, and Quincy Troop. I think he's from East St. Louis. His father used to play baseball. Mm-hmm. And my main question is how the 1960s changed poetry. It even changed Gwendolyn Brooks, because she said she was setting out to be a good poet, and then she read the Ennead, and then that's why she wrote Annie Allen, called the Ennead, because she wanted to bring the common into the heroic.
Uh-huh. And I think she actually wrote that even before a lot of the civil rights movement. That was the book that got her Pulitzer in 1950.
But she was ahead of her time there.
She certainly was. What about that influence, Joe?
Well, I think the crucial time for her was 1967. She went to a conference down at Fisk University that was a meeting of a lot of young black writers, and it was a kind of transforming experience for her. And as you know, at that time, the black arts movement, the black writers were arguing for, a separatism, concentrating their efforts on black topics. And she took that very, very seriously. And she changed radically. She lost a lot of her sense of humor, for one thing. And she started writing in free verse like the younger people did. And she became, I won't say polemical, but I think much more didactic and blunt about point of view. Some of the stuff is very good. Others of it, it's more, as I said, a kind of a propagandistic. There could be arguments about that, of course.
Yeah, many years ago, I was working as a bookseller for a living, and I was selling books at a conference on Robert Hayden's work, actually. Most of the participants were African-American writers or poets, and of course, Gwendolyn Brooks was the star. And I was the bookseller there and selling books by black writers to black artists, and I was feeling a little bit sheepish about this. And I was thinking, oh, Gwendolyn Brooks is going to get very mad at me, But somebody told her this, and she went. She came after her reading, and she came and sat right down beside me to sign her books. I was so thankful for her for that. Helped me out of that difficult situation.
Joseph, before we run out of time, I want to ask you, what role do you think poetry plays in our lives today?
Well, we had a recent series of incidents that reminded us that in times of crisis and great anxiety and pain, people seem instinctively to turn to poetry for some kind of solace or perhaps a way of understanding with the incomprehensible. So I think it's always had that function and always will have. There's, of course, as much diversity in poetry as there is in modern art, generally modern music. So it's hard to make generalizations about it, but I think most people go to poetry as a way of finding out what they themselves feel and think or can express as well as the poet might.
I'm curious about who you're reading these days, which American poets and even particularly which Midwestern poets you might be most intrigued with of people who are working now.
Well, I read just about everything because we get just about everything from everybody, not only published books, but of course works in manuscript. If I were to single out some, then I'm afraid that some people would think, oh, that's what he's looking for. that's
right.
The last thing I'm looking for. I'm looking for something that's different.
Uh-huh. What's your hope for Poetry Magazine for the next few years?
Well, we're going to be celebrating our 90th anniversary next fall. And my hope is that we'll just keep on going doing what we've done trying to find the next Carl Sandburgs and Gwendolyn Brooks and other superb talents who connect with a lot of people.
Well, Joseph, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Joseph Parisi is the editor of Poetry Magazine. We're going to continue talking about Carl Sandburg and Gwendolyn Brooks, and we're also going to continue talking about some of your favorite Midwestern poets. We'd love to hear from you with your input. 866-255-2762 is the number to call. In the next half hour, we're going to be looking particularly at the poetry of Detroit and the Black Arts Movement. But again, we'd like to hear from you with whatever you're reading, whatever really brings something vital into your life right now.
I know that if we get a chance, we'll try to hear from one of my favorite poets, a poet from Southern Ohio, James Wright, if we get time for that next half hour. And we'll also be talking with Melba Boyd, and she'll be with us to talk about some of the poetry that she's collected about the city of Detroit.
Again, we would love to hear from you with your input. Again, the number is 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. If you'd like to get more information on Storylines Midwest or the books we're reading, you can visit our website. That's storylines.ala.org, or you can check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books. They have program schedules. They also have our discussion guides. And Keith, I know that you are a poet yourself, and I want to ask you, Joe Parisi brought up a moment ago that, you know, in the trying times that we've had recently, that a lot of us have been turning to poetry for comfort. Are there any poets particularly that you've turned to recently for comfort?
Well, I've actually just been reading a young Asian American poet named Timothy Liu, and his poetry is so vivid and so direct. He's not Midwestern, I'm afraid, but he lived in Iowa for a while, just like you, Charity. And his poetry is really quite memorable, very exact and precise.
And what role do you think poetry plays in our lives now, Keith?
Oh, I can't answer that with the music on, Charity. I could go on for hours on that question. Poetry is central. Isn't it central to your life?
You're listening to Storylines Midwest, and again, we'd love it if you'd join our conversation. That's 866-255-2762, 866-255-2762.
Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.